Penguin Random House Audio presents For the People, A Story of Justice and Power by Larry Krasner. Read for you by Nathan Krasner. For Lisa, whose blue-gray eyes somehow see the future. Introduction. Shine a light through the eyes of the ones left behind. Elton John, Philadelphia Freedom. I am now the elected district attorney of the city and county of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, one of the largest cities in the United States. Philadelphia is a diverse and wonderfully quirky city known for brotherly love and sisterly affection more recently, Ben Franklin, police corruption and brutality, the U.S. Constitution, cheesesteaks and soft pretzels, Questlove and the Roots, rabid sports fans, patronage, its successive waves of immigration, big city ward politics, the Declaration of Independence, high poverty, high home ownership, a working class attitude, affordability, a great restaurant scene, and its magnetic attraction for millennials. It's also known for bombing itself. But this audiobook is not about my time as DA. It's about the little story of how I got there, and the bigger story of how an outsider movement for criminal justice reform took power and then took office. Before I was sworn in, my long life's work as a lawyer was in criminal defense and civil rights, as far from the work of a traditional prosecutor as a lawyer could be. Back in that life, I joined with other Philly outsiders to push for justice against the insiders in the all-powerful office of the district attorney, the institution I now run. But our work as outsiders didn't accomplish a whole lot, at least not enough, before our movement did the uncomfortable thing. We took back power. We outsiders went inside and took over the institution we had fought against all our lives. Philadelphia is rightly famous for its national parks, historical sites, statuary, and artifacts dedicated to the ideals of freedom and governmental restraint. Independence Mall, in the center of the city, includes the antique Independence Hall, where the Declaration of Independence and U.S. Constitution were drafted in all their deeply flawed glory. The little brick house where Betsy Ross sewed the first American flag from hemp is nearby. Independence Hall looks out at the National Constitution Center, a modern museum across a blocks-long grassy expanse. The tourist-friendly Liberty Bell Center sits on that grassy mall, adjacent to the museum's most recent and smallest addition, its guilty conscience. The slave memorial that roofs over the archaeological remains of General Washington's slaves' quarters. In Mount Vernon, Washington owned 316 slaves. As president in Philadelphia, he owned 9. They were Oney Judge, Christopher Shields, Hercules, Austin, Richmond, Paris, Giles, Mall, and Joe. The stone corners of the slaves' tight lodgings are underground, nearly hidden, visible only from ground level through glass. You have to look down to see them. There are other good reasons to look down in Philly. The many legacies of slavery are also nearly hidden here. Unrestrained government still tramples freedom in the city, this time through its criminal justice system, but it can be hard to see. Consider, for example, that 27% of Pennsylvania's state prisoners in 2017 had been sentenced in only one of the state's 67 counties, Philadelphia. Those incarcerated Philadelphians are hidden in prisons that dot the state's rural and suburban counties, stretching west until they run out at the Ohio border. Sometimes the system hides in plain sight. In Philly, you can't walk down a city block without passing someone currently on county probation or parole. You just don't know who it is. When I was running, Philadelphia's county supervision rate, the rate of people currently on probation and parole, was 1 in 23, higher than in any other big city in America. Among African Americans, the rate was 1 in 14. For African American men in Philly, that rate was even higher. Philly's rate of county supervision was 12 times higher than the supervision rate in New York City, a 2-hour drive north. In comparison, the rate of adults on probation or parole was 1 in 55 in the United States, the most carceral country in the world. Philly's rate was more than twice the national rate. When I ran for DA, what was visible for decades in Philadelphia was an outsized police department the city could ill afford. Philadelphia, currently the country's 6th largest city, had the 4th largest police department, with more than 6,000 uniformed personnel. Despite a 30-year downward trend in crime nationally and locally, and despite being the poorest of the 10 largest cities in the United States, the city continued to fund cops at the expense of desperately needed resources for public education, treatment for mental illness, addiction, and trauma, and economic development. All the things that we know actually prevent crime. Yet, this generously funded police department had not reduced Philadelphia's rates of violent crime compared to other jurisdictions. The national and local downward trend in crime was real, but so is the fact that even during decades of declining crime, Philly chronically had higher violent crime rates than jurisdictions with smaller police departments. The city's war on the freedom of its own citizens was also evident in the fact that, until recently, Philadelphia had sentenced more juveniles to life without any possibility of parole than any other city in the world. Sometimes Philly had sentenced those juveniles to death. Philadelphia remained the only northeastern U.S. city where the death penalty was even available, and it had a history of being one of the most prolific producers of death row residents in the country. Pennsylvania lawmakers hadn't helped their biggest city to reclaim its history as a cradle of freedom. Its legislators had increased the number of criminal offenses to nearly 1,500, a 500% increase from the 1970s, when there were 282 Pennsylvania crimes that worked just fine. Add to that Pennsylvania lawmakers' mad love for mandatory sentencing laws and high sentencing guidelines, and here was what you got. While the rest of the country had increased the number of people in prisons and jails an alarming 500% during the period of mass incarceration starting in the 1980s, Pennsylvania had increased its numbers more than 700% by 2017, with Philadelphia being its primary driver. Pennsylvania has outpaced the rest of the most incarcerating country in the world. Many upstate Pennsylvania legislators' unrelenting urge for incarceration was pragmatic. Mass incarceration benefited their rural, ex-urban, and suburban county economies by feeding their primary industry, public state prisons, once coal and steel were gone. Mass incarceration increased highway funds, never mind that incarcerated people didn't drive, and other federal funding where state prisons were situated because inmate populations were counted in the local census. Mass incarceration also built political power through gerrymandering by counting people in jails as residents even though they couldn't vote. It advanced the careers of politicians who posed as good economic stewards for their counties, talking tough on crime, which affected their counties far less than Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. Meanwhile, these counties, where the coal and steel industries had disappeared, switched to mining the bodies of urban Pennsylvanians. People from somewhere else, whose racial, cultural, and economic differences made locking them up that much easier, and hid them in their state prisons. But my 30 years as a lawyer told me that even lawmakers' powers were slow and limited compared to the power a local chief prosecutor wielded. Legislators had little control over chief prosecutors' decision-making, their discretion to decide how to handle their cases. By the time I ran for Philly's chief prosecutor in 2017, I already knew that chief prosecutors hold the power to make life-changing decisions within their jurisdictions. They unilaterally decide whether or not to use the law to try to kill people, take their freedom, take their clean records and good reputations, take their future employability and their livelihoods, take their ability to form and provide for families, take them away from their families, and take their peace of mind and their money. Chief prosecutors have the latitude to offer favorable or unfavorable deals for guilty pleas on heavy or light charges, to offer diversion programs that avoid convictions, to drop cases, to try cases the right way or the wrong way, and to present honest or untruthful witnesses. They can decide to be impartial or use victims as political pawns, to hide evidence or provide it, to recklessly or purposefully convict the innocent, to leave wrongfully convicted people stuck in jail or help exonerate them, to over-incarcerate or decarcerate, to try to be even-handed or discriminate, to wisely steward society's resources toward prevention and rehabilitation, or burn up so much money on punishment that there's nothing left for anything else. It's a lot of power. And 30 years in courthouses had taught me the sad truth that most chief prosecutors have abused it. When I ran my long-shot campaign to be Philly's chief elected prosecutor, I promised to try to reverse the damage done by traditional prosecution. I wasn't supported by the usual centrist power brokers, but I wasn't alone. I and other progressive prosecutors who were elected before and after me ran.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?